Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, and this is episode 155, and we're here to talk about Arrival. Not The Arrival, but Arrival, the one without Charlie Sheen in it.
Oh, that's the only thing this movie was missing, Charlie Sheen. I knew it.
Charlie Sheen and maybe Carl Urban.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
I feel like most movies are missing Carl Urban, but...
You bet.
We don't need to talk about that. That'll just make us sad.
It will. And we have a special guest with us this time, and Rose. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. You have been here before.
I have.
I think last time was when we talked about Aliens, I believe. Is that right?
Yep.
All right. Cool. Which is one of the very finest episodes we've ever done.
Of course.
Yes.
It was certainly good for Mother's
Day. I mean, we try and ignore Hannah being in it, but...
That's right. And that's episode 134, by the way.
Very good.
And this movie, Arrival... directed by, I think his name is Denis. I have no idea how to pronounce his last name. Villeneuve.
Villeneuve.
Okay. And I heard his name pronounced Denis. It's D-E-N-I-S. And it is based on...
Francais.
Yeah. It's based on one of my favorite short stories of all time, which we actually talked about back on... And I actually looked this up... let's see, sorry, there it is, back on episode 11.
Wow.
When we were like 22 years old, we did this podcast about Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang, and the story in it that's called Story of Your Life is the basis for this movie, called Arrival, and Oscar nominated, right? Best Picture, nomination, made in 2016.
I have to say, when I heard that they were going to adapt this story, I couldn't believe it because the story itself is intricate and very thoughtful and does some things that I just didn't think would translate to film, and they did such a spectacular job.
Oh, good. I'm glad you thought so.
It was really great.
Yeah. When I watched it, I watched it in the movie theater when it came out because I couldn't not do that. And I was blown away. I was really surprised, just like you were, because I love the story so much. And I was like, how on earth can they make this into a movie? I had no idea how they could do it. And they did it. They really did it. And it was really terrific. In a lot of ways, they're two distinct things, which we can talk about later.
Oh, yeah.
But in a lot of ways, they nailed it. And I can't imagine a better adaptation.
No.
What did you think, Rose?
So I went into the theater knowing almost... I didn't read the short story before I saw the movie. So I knew very little about it. Other than, like, aliens show up. And, you know, Amy Adams goes to talk to them. But so I was really interested through the whole thing.
Good.
In a way, Mom probably wasn't, because she
did
a little more about it.
Did it make sense to you? Did you come out of it perplexed, or did you were you blown away? Or
I was blown away. It was really interesting. And it's funny because most movies, that's kind of the part they bypass is like, and the aliens can speak English, so you know,
yeah,
by crazy coincidence. So it was kind of interesting seeing a movie that actually dealt with the problem of how you would communicate with aliens.
That's cool. That's good. And I've read numerous science fiction novels and stories throughout, you know, many, many, many years that have dealt with that problem. So the problem wasn't new to me, you know, in literature, it's not new, but the story, when I first read this story, it completely blew me away because it was intelligent. It was science fiction and it was human. You know, the characters were amazing. It was just terrific. It was everything.
And for me, the idea of the aliens not knowing or not being able to speak English was interesting because the stories I've read, it's always us going somewhere and encountering the aliens and not being able to speak their language and having to learn it. So in addition, we're learning about the aliens. Most of the time that I can think of, when the aliens come here, they're prepared. Or they don't care because they're going to eat us or kill us or whatever they're going to do.
Right.
So it was kind of interesting to think of these super intelligent beings that were so far beyond us that they could come here. But we don't know your language. Hmm. That's not usually the way I think of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, let's do a quick synopsis of this movie. And I think we all feel pretty strongly that this is a movie that you should watch and not hear about. Yeah. So yep. we're just going to just briefly synopsize the movie, and then we're going to get into discussion where we're not going to worry about that. So if you haven't seen the movie, by all means, go see it. but what it's about is Amy Adams is the main character, and she's a linguist. And all around the globe, I think there was 12 ships landed at various places throughout the world and basically just sat there. And she was approached. She's a university professor, and she was approached because of a project she had done in the past for the military. And she had some clearances and such. But anyway, this colonel, played by Forrest Whitaker, shows up and says, "What do you make of this?" and plays her some sounds of the aliens speaking, which, you know, you can't make anything out of that. And said, "Here, basically, translate this, would you?" I mean, he had a pretty unreasonable expectation, you know, hoping that she had something to say about this short little clip that would help them understand what the aliens were saying. But anyway, one thing leads to another, and she ends up going there in order to attempt to communicate with these aliens.
Yeah, this language sounds like, I don't know, a dog panting or something hitting its nose against the wall. Or I mean, it sounds like nothing you would even recognize as language, which I also thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I couldn't make out any distinct words or anything like that, and neither could she. And it was cool, you know, from the very outset, you could tell it was going to be smart because the way she talked about language just right then, you know, they're starting to talk about, well, what is language, you know, and, you know, I can't do anything with this. I have to interact with them. And that immediately started my brain running where it's like, yeah, well, of course you couldn't. To assume that you could was kind of silly. And, you know, the Army basically wanted her to translate it without taking her there. You know, here's an audio
tape. Whitaker's a soldier, damn it, Jim.
That's
also,
right.
I'm like, if you didn't want to take her there, like, I know for a fact they were taking video recordings. Like, you couldn't show her a recording of the alien talking.
That's true, too. But she was saying, hey, we need to interact. I need to be able to, you know, do what she did and say, I am this. And what do you think of that, alien? You know?
Well, and they start up front with interesting ideas about language because they said, okay, well, we're going to go talk to someone else. And they're like, so-and-so in California. She knows who it is. It sounds like it's a rival, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're leaving, and she's going, ask them the, was it Somali?
Sanskrit.
Sanskrit word for war. Ask him what it means. And he's like, huh. And so when he shows up, he says, what does the Sanskrit word for war mean? And she said something about a dispute over how many cows you get or something like that.
Right, right.
She says, what did he say? And he says, disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, pack your bags.
Yeah.
Because she had a more interesting and realistic sounding idea of it. I mean, it was just really interesting just even thinking about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, because that tells you right there that, like, in the Sanskrit culture, cows are the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're what you would have a war over.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we run into that all the time in the Bible, right? You know, it's really important to us to know who was being written for, right? Who is this? Who is this letter being written to, and who were they, and what were the important things in their lives? You know, so that there are things that don't make sense to us here in 2016 without a little bit of context.
Well, and I think we run into it in everyday life. I'm just rereading, well, I'm reading the revised edition of
something about
how to defend the faith without raising your voice. And they're talking about the fact that, you know, between 2012 and 2015, when they revised it, they're like, there's been a shift in our culture. And so you might think you're talking about Christianity to someone who doesn't know anything about it. And what you're really doing is talking to secularized Christians who've left the church, but without them really realizing how internalized they have become with all the Christian ideas of how people treat each other. They're using those concepts, but they're talking about them from a different point of view altogether.
Yeah.
So it's that same thing that, so the whole book is about how do you both get on the same page?
So that you're not just using the words that mean the same to each other? Is that what you mean?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, they're saying, how can you be so awful? And you have to stop and really, or the church, and you have to stop and go, what's the positive thing they're worried about? Is it love? Is it end of life? Is it suffering? Is it whatever? And then you have to respond with not the same arguments you would have used to a Christian who understands where you're coming from, kind of like in code, the same language. Mm-hmm. You have to stop and pull out of the framework they expect you to be in, out of that box, and go, we do care about that. Here's the context for why we approach it the way we do. And the book already was kind of set up that way, but the book now kind of just has more of an emphasis on the idea that a lot of the people that we might come into conflict with or who don't like the church are coming at it from a point of view of extreme individualism not anchored in Christianity.
Interesting.
Which is way past where I meant to go with this, but it's that whole idea of if we're not speaking each other's language and it's hard for us right here on this planet in the same culture, how hard is it for linguists or, you know, in this arrival where they don't even know what concepts they're thinking of or why they're there?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, because she talks about that when she talks about how you would ask the question, like, what is your purpose here? Because she talks about, like, you need to figure out if they think of themselves as individuals or, like, one conglomerate thing. You need to figure out if they understand the idea of sequences of time. You need to figure out if they understand the concept of, like, having a goal or a purpose. And those are all cultural things.
Right, or what a question is.
Yeah.
You know what a question is, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so fascinating. So you can tell, if you haven't seen the movie, you can tell that it really delves into a lot of this stuff.
Well, this makes it sound really cool, very academic. And it is on one level, although they make it very interesting. But the other thing is that simultaneously, they are showing that in the 12 places where these ships showed up, different cultures are responding very differently. The Chinese are acting in a more of a warlike way. The Russians, we don't know what they're thinking. They will or won't tell us what they're learning from everyone. So you've also got panic from all the general populace who doesn't know anything about it except that these showed up. They haven't seen pictures of anything, and I think wisely so once we see the pictures. But they're, of course, very upset and suspicious. And so there's riot and mayhem going on, looting. And I would have thought that was ridiculous until we had all the reactions to the Donald Trump presidency, where everybody's just out there marching because they want to show how unhappy they are. And so I was like, oh, okay. I'm not saying that was the same thing, but you get people who are on the edge and panicked and worried about their families and everything, and they address that in the movie too. And so that kind of puts it into a different context than the story did, where it was a much more isolated look at the whole situation.
Yeah, that's one of the main amazing things about what they pulled off in this movie, I think. And it's an aspect that wasn't in the original story, but to do, you know, the worldwide and the intensely personal stuff that's going on with Amy Adams, and just to do all of that in the movie, you know, so it was like epic in a way, and personal as well. They did a really cool job.
It was really well done because they were able to address all these kind of nerdy linguistic things that we're talking about, mm-hmm. but keep it really interesting because of the global and yeah. national panic.
Right, so. Right. All right, well, did we do a decent synopsis? Did we turn people away? So far, what they've got is a lecture on linguistics. But it's
wouldn't everyone want to go yeah. see that? What's wrong here?
That's right. Yeah, and the aliens, the way that they communicate and their written language, it's just awesome. Mm-hmm. They did, you know, how it looked. Everything was just really great. I just, yeah, you know, I'm waiting to delve into this, to the stuff in detail.
Yeah, I was going to say, but this movie pulled up off somehow being an epic science fiction movie, you know, without people having to, you know, take down the Death Star. Mm. And, but also being something that was intellectually rich so you could go back to it. They merged it really well, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, here's our line then, you know, so
in the
after
sand,
this, after this, we're going to talk about it freely. So, again, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that you watch it before listening to the rest of this podcast, more so than in most other movies.
Yes.
Right. All right. So awesome. There, podcast is over.
We've been set free.
That's right. So, I thought it was absolutely fascinating and kind of 2001-like how, you know, their first encounter with the spaceship, you know, they went up with this scissor lift, which is this everyday thing, right? This everyday thing, mm-hmm, and they use yeah. that to go up into the spaceship. And then this amazing thing happens inside where gravity is shifted and they're all amazed. And, you know, how they lingered in that scene reminded me of 2001. How, you know, it seemed to take a long time in that corridor. Mm-hmm. And I think that it worked really well. I didn't feel like it was too long or anything, but it was interesting how long that they stayed there and before they got into the room with the big screen on it.
Yeah. Because they really showed everyone's reaction mm-hmm. and how nervous people were and how long it would take and how... You know, because Amy Adams, she didn't want to jump off the scissor lift.
Yeah, right. And they're wearing these huge, bulky outfits, too. And I thought that was really cool. I mean, it was a complete distrust of the mm-hmm. aliens who had created the atmosphere in there and everything. You know, mm-hmm. clearly they weren't breathing oxygen. Yet they created this this atmosphere and everybody's so nervous, you know, especially the military. They're so nervous that they put everybody in these giant suits and they figure, you know, well, we've got disease to worry about. We've got all these things to worry about. And the canary in the cage.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff that they had to worry about. And then I just loved the moment, which wasn't in that first visit, but a few visits down the road. You know, you go through this huge rigmarole. You put on the suit. You go up the scissor lift. You get in there and all this stuff. And you're... You know, they only want him to stay in there for so long and all this stuff because of all these worries that they have. And then she gains trust or is wanting to gain trust from them and finally decides she's not wearing this thing anymore. And I loved that moment when she pulled that thing off and said, I need them to see me.
Right.
But I loved it. You know, it had to have been trust on her part. You know, she did look at the canary and the canary was okay. But mm-hmm. there had to be some logic at some point where you're like, well, they went through all this trouble to create our atmosphere. And they're clearly not, you know, they can kill me anytime they want to. And they haven't. So at some point, you got to trust.
Well, also, I didn't even, and trust is the right word, except that it wasn't trust like, oh, they're fine. They're wonderful. They just want to talk to us. It was more of born, I think, of her passion to, mm-hmm. we got to get on with this.
Sure.
I can't talk to them if they can't even see who I am and what I'm doing and what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was, you know, it was a calculated risk, I felt like. She glanced at the canary and went, okay, this is happening.
Right.
Just jumped in there. And that's kind of funny because... That's reflected in her behavior at the very end, too, where she's like, this is a calculated risk, but the benefit is worth it, where she makes her choice to go mm-hmm. ahead and have the baby. or to, you know, start the sequence of events that will lead to her child.
Yeah. So we haven't talked about that part at all, where, you know, she's throughout the movie seeing visions of her daughter. And I guess one question that I have for you both is, did you feel that she was going backwards and forwards in time, backwards or forwards in time, actually, you know, physically or mentally going there, or was she remembering things?
So I hadn't read the book. So I thought it was flashbacks.
Okay.
They do the, where they tell you basically the abbreviated story of her daughter's life at the very beginning. So I feel like they're kind of playing off your expectation that this is something that's happened to her and she is flashing back to it through the whole thing. And in fact, when she, when her daughter asks her the Dirosum term, and she then thinks of the word and tells her daughter, and like the next, like after she hears it, I didn't think she was flashing forward to the future. I thought she was changing the past.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I have to say, even though I'd read the story, we, you know, when was that? Episode 11, and
episode
we're on 55,
yeah.
So I hadn't read it since then. And I remembered the essence of it, but I didn't really stop to think about the daughter and her place and everything until about a third of the way into the movie, or maybe about halfway into the movie, I suddenly remembered what exactly how all this applied. And I kind of almost started crying because I remembered the very end and what she says at the end. And my husband looks at me and he goes, "Are you okay?" Because there was nothing going on to make me feel that way. But it all came into focus. And so up to that point, I also was thinking of her as being in the past, frankly. And especially I thought skillful was the way that they went from the little montage of here's the brief idea of I had a daughter and here was her life. And then they go to her kind of just trudging across the commons area where everybody's gathering around the TV. She's not even looking, going into the classroom, getting ready to start class. So you feel like she's just been thinking about that stuff and she's very depressed.
Yeah.
So they kind of carry that on really well. So that establishes that this is all in the past.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that moment, that zero-sum game moment, you know, when I watched the movie, you know, and I knew, you know, the story was fairly fresh, even when I watched the movie, because I think I reread it right before I watched it.
Yeah, I waited.
Yeah, so, but, you know, the zero-sum game thing, I still didn't feel like she was back there. I still felt like she was, it was a flashback and she was remembering the word, having said it. And it still felt to me like it was in the past. You know, so trying to experience the movie, you know, that first time going through it, it was in the alien ship with the aliens when they revealed, that
you
she is
see
seeing
future.
The future that, I think that that's an audience that I was in the movie theater, which was maybe half full. That's when everybody in there seemed to get it. You know, you could really tell everybody was going, "Oh my gosh!" You know,
there was a reaction.
There was a reaction. Yeah.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
We saw it at the Dollar Movie, which was maybe a fourth full, and everybody was really spread out. And it was, I will say, it was silent the entire time. Everybody was just watching that movie as hard as they could.
Wow. Yeah.
No one was eating popcorn or getting up and going out or anything.
Yeah. Well, and I think they did a good job of, since a lot of it's about how humans perceive time versus how these aliens perceive time, I think they did a good job on playing on humans' expectations of a timeline. We heard the story of the daughter and her death first.
Yeah.
So we think that everything she's seeing is a flashback. If she'd just been flashing to moments of her daughter's life, there may have been people that were less certain that it was a flashback. but we already saw her die. So in a human's mind, it's already happened.
Yeah, and every time she, once I remembered exactly kind of the how everything worked, she would see something and kind of react, and she'd go, give me a moment, but was always stuff where you would expect her to kind of go, I didn't expect to be hit by this memory like this.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and then really and then when it got to the point where, okay, you knew that, you know that she's seeing the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or remembering the future is how I'd put it still.
Right.
And then she remembered the guy's phone number because he told it to her at the party, right? But I still felt like, you know, that was a remembering of the future. They're basically saying, well, the past and the future are the same, you know, both directions.
And but she actually doesn't seem to be remembering the future in the movie. Because of the scene where she's getting the guy's number, she has no recollection of calling him. Mm-hmm. So it seems like she's not remembering the future as much as she's just living her life out of order.
So at that point, you felt like she was really in the future.
Yeah.
And then came back.
Because she doesn't remember calling him. Because she hasn't, in her own timeline, called him yet.
Okay.
Yeah, because she's kind of going, isn't she kind of going, come on, come on, come on, like to her memory.
Yeah, and that's I still felt like she was remembering the future, and she was remembering that event, and she was like, oh, but yeah, I could certainly see that. That's one of the questions I had, because I had talked to someone who felt like she was actually moving around.
Oh, no.
And but for her to have gone to the future, experienced that, and then now that's a memory of hers, and now she has the phone number to call the guy with. So it's like she lived the future first.
Right. She was, to me, it wasn't that she was remembering the future, because you can't remember it until you've done it. But it was kind of like that, the idea of, and this is, you know, something we talked about in the story. It kind of gives you a more of an idea of how it is when they say that God is outside of time, but people are still free to act within time. Even and without, and so she was kind of those moments, she was outside of time. And so she was seeing what would happen, but she hadn't done it yet. So how could she remember it? Because she hadn't done it yet. She had to see what was happening. And so that was the part of the movie that I initially had a problem with, because, you know, there's that whole thing of, well, because it happened in the future, you remembered it in the past. I'm always like, oh, I hate that in a science fiction movie. And then I realized that the way the Chinese general is showing her his phone and going, I have a feeling you might need to see this. And here's what my wife said to me right before she died, and whispers it in her ear. And I feel like on the phone, when we go back to the present, she's speaking to him in Chinese. We have no idea what's going on. And we can't always hear what she's saying. So if you could speak Chinese, you don't really know exactly what she's saying. And I think she was telling him, you have to tell me these things when we meet in the future. I'll explain it later. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
amazing. But yeah, I had the same thought about God as well, because, you know, what they're saying here is, you know, the story of your life is a one whole thing. And, you know, Amy Adams is said to be able to see the entire thing start to finish from where she is, right? From the point in time that she is. And then, you know, you've got all these free will things to be thinking about and all that stuff. But yet that's what we say God can do. It's what we say God does, right? God can see everything. He knows.
But we still have the freedom to make our own choices.
But we still have the freedom to make our own choices, right? Yet it's already happened in a way.
Yeah.
It's perplexing. Yep.
But it's that thing of the aliens writing a whole idea all at once in one symbol.
Right.
Everything is contained. There's no order to it. It's just complete in and of itself. And it contains the entire thought.
And I love that, too. And they explained it, you know, imagine if you had, if you were writing a sentence with two hands and you're coming into the middle. and you have to know exactly all the words you're going to say. And you need to know how much space each one's going to use. And you're going to write it and meet in the middle perfectly. Which is, you know, amazing. So it's like, you know, just this. And I loved that coffee stain method, you know, or whatever.
Yeah,
it looked like a coffee stain, but it's just like, that was just so cool. I have no idea where that came from.
Wonderful,
but it was
too.
Neat. Mm-hmm.
The circle.
Yeah.
with the spikes going out. You know, that's the circle is one complete thing, and the spikes are the thing that make it look different from the other stuff. So that's how they saw time.
Right.
And their language. And
And she kind of discovered that their written language and their spoken language were two different things. And that was interesting, too.
Well, and that's also, though, I did listen to John McWhorter. I don't know if you know of him. I'd heard of him recently. Mm-hmm. And he has done a book called The Language Hoax, which is talking about this language theory that on the which the book, I guess, is somewhat based.
Oh, the Worf thing that you spoke to me about. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he has a podcast, which is really good, called the Lexicon Valley Podcast. It's from Slate, but it's
cool.
He's really interesting on it. But anyway, I was listening to him talk about this movie because he's like, how great is this for linguists that there's a movie about language like this? And he was saying that every written language is not really can't ever be totally representative of the language it's representing. You know, yeah, we have symbols that mean sounds, but like I glance over at Rose and she just met my eyes and nodded. Well, that's a whole part of the language. It's not going to get in there. Or I'm going to have to write it down in a way that's different and conveys different meaning. You know, so he was like, in a sense, that's somewhat true for all of us. That's why she was saying, Amy Adams was saying, I have to see them.
Right, right.
Because your language just isn't what you're saying. And he was saying any real linguist would be listening to how they talk first, because that's really language.
Right.
But of course, in this movie, that wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, after you talked to me about, or you sent me a link to this Worf, I think it's Whorf.
Yeah.
I watched one of the DVD extras, and Ted Chiang was there.
Oh.
And he was talking a little bit about the story, and he mentioned the exact thing, you know, the Worf thing. And it was mentioned in the movie, too. But he said that this guy, he supposed or had this theory that in the Hopi language, I guess he did a bunch of work in the Hopi language. Yeah. But Ted Chiang, by the way, did say all of this was discredited. He said, but the idea was amazing. So, you know, but it was part of what his thinking was when he did it. But he did know that it was discredited. But he said, you know, the Hopi language was set up in such a way that they would really understand relativity intuitively. And that was this Worf's hypothesis after all this years of work. And then he said, well, it was discredited, but isn't it an amazing thought? You know,
and that's what I was thinking about that after I listened to that podcast. And I thought, well, that's what science fiction does. Yeah. It doesn't have to worry about if the idea is true. And especially Ted Chiang is good at this. He says, what if this was true? What does that mean?
Hmm.
And this is his exploration of it.
Right. Right.
And I think it's also undeniable to say that to a lesser extent, language does shape how you think. If you have words for a concept, you're more likely to understand that concept than you are if you have no language for it, even if you're thinking about things for yourself.
Yeah.
And I think it also affects memory. If you have a more expanded vocabulary in your own memory, you can associate more specific words with events, and which I think would help you remember them differently than if you had a different set of words to associate with it.
Yeah,
and they've done, there was a study someone did where it was with a culture that had like different words for light blue and dark blue and a culture that didn't. It was just one word for blue. And they showed them two shades of blue. And then later they showed them a shade of blue and asked them which one it was. And the people that had different words for light blue and dark blue were better able to remember that because they already had the words to associate with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And I believe you too. We've talked here before about, you know, the word love and how there's, you know, five words for it. And we have one in English, but the concepts of the different things are just harder to express in English, right?
Well, yeah, and I think the whole point of this movie, and the story, but the movie did such a great job of showing it, is what, and when you say love, it makes me think of what are we willing to associate with love, with mm-hmm. the word and our concept for it, because Louise leans into the suffering that having a child she loves, but she knows will die, is associated with. She's like, that suffering is worth it. It's part of the whole experience, and otherwise I don't get any of it. I won't know that person. Hmm. You know, and that's kind of the Catholic way of looking at it. And one of the things that was different in this movie than in the story is in the movie they made the choice to have Ian leave her because he was mad about the choice she made. Now, they don't say exactly what, so they're leaving it open. But what the association I made was that he's like, oh my gosh, this child's going to die because didn't the little girl say he looks at me differently now?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was so tragic.
Because he knows she's going to die. Well, mm-hmm. So he can't. Now, of course, this is his pain and his suffering, of course. But he can't look past that or look at the whole the way she is allowed to look at the whole and see all the joy despite it. That the suffering is worth it. And that would be more of the Catholic theory about suffering, is that it's, of course, you don't want suffering. You want to avoid it or help others not have it, but you can't avoid it. Life, as another great movie says, The Princess Bride, life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says otherwise is selling something.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have to go for is, what is the greater good? What is the big picture? What do we get out of the suffering? Sometimes there can be gifts given in suffering as we go through and we learn or we expand or we are able to pray and offer that up, you know, I mean,
yeah.
While we're trying to get out of it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if you could see a tragic end, do you accept the joy anyway?
Yeah.
Right. And Ted Chiang did say in that same interview, that was the original idea, was, you know, if you were able to see the future, would you make the same decisions as you're right. making now without it? How would a person who could see that all that act?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. And that, yeah, it's really profound.
Well, and because then that leaves you to things like where you can't see the future. And you're making choices to try to avoid suffering, like abortion, mm-hmm. whether it's avoiding your suffering or avoiding, you know, oh, they say this child will be like this because of genetic testing or whatever reason. Or, you know, now I've broken up with the father, or I don't know, 1,000 different reasons that are given. Mm-hmm. But there's the potential for great joy, as we can see, in that unborn life. And happiness and good and many, many other things that we can't see. So when we make these real definite, especially life choices like that, we're cutting ourselves short. And I thought the movie, I don't think they did it that way deliberately, but everything in there kind of leads into that whole idea of don't be quick to make a final decision like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like it's, yeah, profound message. And the correct answer, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you know, was the last line of the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the movie as well, but.
Right. I was looking for it.
Hold interesting.
I have the book here.
Oh, okay.
If I can get to the end of the story. I marked the beginning, not the end. Oh, yeah. I unwrap his arms from around me, and we hold hands as we walk inside to make love, to make you.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So what did you guys think about how it was shot? It seemed kind of dark.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the scenes were dark. The brightest thing that I can remember in my head was the alien's space.
Yeah.
So was a human space sort of made darker? And I mean, the scene where we first see the aliens, you know, it's overcast and rainy, not a very good day, right?
Yeah.
What did you think of that? Did you, what was a director's purpose in that, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's definitely like the real world looked real. I don't know what his intention was. But it wasn't, you know, a glamorized version of real life.
Yeah.
Yeah, because think of poor Amy Adams. This is giving it up for the craft. She's carrying the whole movie, and I've never seen her look frumpier, or she kind of looked fat, and, you know, she never looked beautiful. I mean, I'm not saying she didn't look nice or anything, but she wasn't movie star quality beautiful. She was a regular person, you know, with her hair kind of messed up. And like I said, at one point she was just wearing a t-shirt and jeans or something, and I went, oh, did she gain weight for this? What happened? You know, yeah. I just didn't expect it.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. How, you know, the look of it and everything. You know, one of the main differences between the movie and the story was the reaction of the world.
Yeah.
So I wonder why they made that choice too.
I think so. Someone once told me something that always kind of stuck with me about the concept of adaptation, which is art in its truest form can't be adapted to any other medium and say the same thing. So if you adapt it, you kind of have to take into account the medium you're adapting it to. It won't be the same as the original. And so it seems like that's kind of especially true with the book and the movie. And part of it is it's a little unrealistic, I think, of the short story to say that no one but the government and the tabloids were talking about it. So it wasn't really like a huge thing because he didn't want to talk about that, which is totally fine.
Sure.
But in this case, they had the spaceships actually land down, which made it more of a global event. And then it's also the things you can be vague about and specific about in the movie versus the short story are completely different. You know, when you're watching the movie or in the story, they talk about the aliens' language. It's a spindly language. It's everything's expressed in one thought. But like, you can't have like that kind of vague description of it in the movie. It has to be this language. It has to be the language we're showing you.
Yeah.
But so the movie can't be specific about that in the way the book can, but the movie or the book, when they talk about the things she's remembering, talks about the things she's remembering in future tense versus past tense, which is the aliens. Whereas the movie doesn't have to choose a tense. The movie just puts sequences of scenes together without any sort of context as to the ultimate timeline. So the movie is allowed to be vague about things in the way the short story isn't. And so I think a lot of the stuff that they adapted is because of that.
Well, I would also say that the stuff with the world and the stuff with the other countries was really needed in order to make people want to see the movie, because you need some kind of dynamic tension. And just the tension of her memories and the tension of, or as we think they are, and the tension of trying to discover the language isn't enough to carry a movie. It's fine for a short story, and it's a really great short story, and I love it, but you've got to have something else going on that you care about. And so the thing pushing them with a deadline and having other things to accomplish is the reaction of those two soldiers who are worried about the aliens being evil, and they represent all of the people who are rioting, the different people speaking on the monitors from around the world, showing the range from, you know, oh, when we talk about higher math concepts, they're better than when we talk about algebra. And you're like, oh, they chose math. Huh. What does that also say about us? So they use it two ways. But it also, when the Chinese and the Russians are cutting off contact, it says something about outside forces coming in. So I thought they really did a spectacular job of keeping it interesting, you know, making you still care. Because otherwise you're just sitting there drifting along in something that turns into a documentary mm-hmm. of sorts about aliens and learning
yeah,
language.
Yeah, right in the middle of the movie is this little documentary.
Yeah.
I love that. And it was so effective, too.
Yeah. Well, and for a movie about language, it was kind of important to show the way language divides the world, because she was having to translate stuff that the Chinese were saying that they'd right. picked up, and to try yeah. and figure out what the Chinese were doing.
That's an excellent point. Yeah.
Well, and I also loved the way they used the idea of culture, because then you find out at one point that everybody's chosen a different way to try to communicate. You know, they brought in, everybody's got their specialists, but the Chinese are using mahjong, a tile game. So it's a competitive thing. And as she points out, she goes, if what you're doing and the way you discuss things and learn the concepts is compete with each other, what message are you giving? And that's what she was worried about. But what I thought was interesting is the way they were trying, that they thought, oh, here's something foreign. Let's all do it together, you know, or whatever. Here's something we can all understand together. I just loved that idea. One set chooses math. They choose, you know, language. They, you know, it just depends on who their specialist is and what people are asking to find out, for one thing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, one of the reasons that I thought it would be so difficult, or that I couldn't see a movie in it, is because it was so internal. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff that happens in there is in the character's head. You know, she's expressing this stuff, you know, but most of it's so intensely internal. And I guess another one of the profound changes, I would say, between the two is her daughter. In the movie, her daughter died of a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And in the story, she died in I think it was a rock climbing accident.
I thought it was a skiing accident, but whatever it was, it was some outdoor.
It was, yeah, she was sort of a risk taker, and, you know, they clashed quite a bit, mother and daughter, in her life. And, you know, despite her efforts to sort of steer her away from that, you know, the daughter's decisions are what ended up being her demise.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of necessary in the movie to change it because we get so much of her internal monologue in the story. We understand her talking about the Book of Ages and why she didn't, you know, change what happened, even though she could have just told her daughter, like, don't go on this trip and do this thing.
That would have been one storyline too many, probably.
Well, and it would have been impossible to tell, really. I mean, it would have completely changed what the movie was. And in this, it would have hijacked the conversation, certainly. In this, there is no option. There's no way to change the fact that her daughter's going to die, but she does it anyway. So you keep the same conundrum of, you know, would you have your child, even if they were going to cause you suffering, without having the whole thing just wind up being a debate on, yeah, but she should have told her.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I agree with that one completely. I just found it, you know, it's fascinating to, it makes me want to try to write a script from another story that can't be a movie.
There you go.
Find one and try to write a script, because the writer really just nailed it. Because I watched the two, and I do agree, they're totally distinct things. They're two different things, absolutely. Yet they are related in theme, and what the screenplay writer kept, to me, was the core of what Ted Chiang said in the story. So he didn't change anything that I would consider vitally important. The soul of it exists in both.
And actually, what I like too is, I mean, the story is able to tell you some things like, "Wow, you're so different than I am." And so some more of what she was experiencing in watching this person grow up.
Mm.
And so that's part of what you understand in why she makes the choice she does. In the movie, you're right. Otherwise, then she's just doing a monologue about, you're so different from me, blah, 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 blah. And they don't do that. What they do is they choose all those little moments that every parent has of inconsequential seeming highs and lows. The I love you, I hate you, the prancing around in the cowboy suit, the, you know, whatever it is, the walking around in the river. And those are those moments that make up life, and those are the moments she sees in the future. And that's why instead of the big things like the birthday party, the wedding, the, you know, those moments are big and important, but it's the other stuff that we feel deeply, I think, too.
Mm.
You know, that's the joy that she's choosing.
Yeah.
Despite the suffering.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, and that made me think, you know, we were talking about God's view. And so is that kind of his view of us in a sense? I mean, I, of course, knowing that he's, you know, overall and better than that, but is this kind of a way of coming to grips a little bit with this, you know, when we're, I love you, I hate you. Oh yeah, I'm going to pray. Not totally not wanting to, sneaking off in a corner and doing something else instead. And yeah. Also the idea of the 12 countries way of communicating with the aliens. Is this like us? We all have our own different way. Because the aliens just kind of put it out there. They're willing to communicate with people however they want to. They're not dictating anything. They're just kind of receiving and responding, giving back to try and see what's the best way to get through.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting thing too, you know?
It was. Did you catch when they said, you know, the reason why they were there,
mm-hmm.
why they were communicating with humans in the first place?
In the
was
movie.
Because they would need humanity in 3,000 years to yeah. help them. And I thought that was cool.
Well, that's Rose liked that better than the story. See, I liked the story better. The mm-hmm. story, they just left and no one knew why.
Right, they left and never, yeah. And it was a mystery.
Yeah, and yeah. I kind of, maybe that ties into my feelings about, you know, we just don't understand God's ways. And I know they're not God, but... It made them more alien to me than we're going to need something from you. So we're here to say, it's okay that they did that. That's fine. Rose liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it certainly in the movie versus the short story. I mean, this is the other thing is when you're telling a movie, there's different expectations on what you're going to deliver than if you're writing a short story, which can just be focused on a specific idea without necessarily needing a bunch of resolutions in the way a movie would. But for a movie, I think if they'd left it of like, and then the aliens left and no one knew why, like that is a little bit of a cop-out, I think, for a movie. And it also changes the way we feel about the whole thing. Because, especially because they've brought this global element in where there's like rioting and there's rebellions and there's all of these problems that are being caused by the aliens being there. If they just left for, and I mean, that would completely change
mm-hmm.
the way society functioned. So it's one of those things where like it would open like a whole new can of worms at the end that yeah, would be need. That wouldn't be dealt with. Whereas the short story never had it be a global event, really. I mean, it was global, but like not as much in the global awareness as it was in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that idea of, you know, humankind's self-destructiveness is something that's addressed in science fiction all over the place. And, well, Arthur C. Clarke did it too, you know, where mm-hmm. aliens come in and they say, you guys need some serious assistance because you are going to be gone if you don't change your ways. And, you know, there are other movies as well. Even The Magnificent point. Contact was like that, right?
Everyone's favorite science fiction movie, right?
That's right. And yeah. we do need to mention Contact here because there are a heck of a lot of similarities. You know, Arrival is definitely a superior
really?
Film. Yeah. Like,
no, I think there are similarities. Yeah,
the similarities, I just you know. Don't wanna... Yeah, aliens as well, but the worldwide reaction and yeah. remember they blew up the some people blew up the machine.
Here's my contact. Worst admission ever.
Mm-hmm.
I remember very little about that movie because I really did not like it. As you know,
I know it. You
I
bet.
Mostly remember mm-hmm. they should have sent a poet. Which was the best line in the entire movie.
Well, and Matthew McConaughey is the priest. He's like, well, you know, celibacy, that's a thing I don't feel like I need to worry about, so I really need to take my shirt off.
A man of the cloth without the cloth, but...
Right.
But, yeah.
Well,
Arrival is definitely a superior movie, so...
Well, yeah, Jeremy Renner is unfortunately relegated to the necessary companion to bounce things off of. And I do feel, Rose and I were talking about this, that they really did miss a chance in the movie when he's like, science is more important, physics is more important, or whatever. But they never even give him two lines to explain why that might be. And I was kind of interested in hearing a debate about it. I thought they were going to have a bit of sparring at some point.
Yeah.
And he was needed, you know, later. But you didn't feel like it's
he mentioned it. They had a very, very short debate on the, you could call it a debate, but on the helicopter.
But that was no, it wasn't really a debate. I mean, he says, she says language is what brings a community together. And he says, no, it's technology or science or whatever he says. And then
she's looks at him.
And then she says something, you know, some pithy thing about, but language does this, and then, that's it. He never gets his rejoinder.
I was waiting for him to come back later and for them to, be having that cup of coffee or do a walk and talk somewhere, and they didn't. And I did feel let down by that, you know.
Also because they bypassed a lot of the it was somebody else. That was it. It was somebody else who figures out that they understand calculus, but not geometry.
That was one of the other countries. Yeah.
So Jeremy Renner doesn't even get to do that.
poor guy.
You know, by the second half of the movie, he's working on the language stuff with her. They don't even show him doing any math stuff anymore.
Yeah, and in the story they did.
All the things are connected, but that's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he gets undercut a lot. He's mostly just needed to father her child in the future.
Which is kind of true to the story, too. So, yeah. But the physics is more important in the story. It's the part that I wasn't able to follow again. So,
the physics in a story is what you...
Yeah.
Okay.
The charts, the graphs, the... And then this happens, and light bends and does this. And I was like, oh, crap.
Oh, no.
We're really going to talk about this.
You bet.
I know that was your favorite part. You reread those parts, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was actually, it was funny because no one ever said the thing I thought they were going to say, which is the reason light goes to that point is because it's the fastest point it can get to.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that wasn't relevant. I mean, it didn't seem like light chose that point and was trying to just get there as quickly as possible. Light just got there because that was the fastest thing it could get to.
It was headed in that direction already, and it was zooming as fast as it could go. Right. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of light, really. It's not. Yeah, they did make it seem in the story, the way he was trying to describe it, I guess, so that we could get it, was like light picked something out to go to. And I was like, what? I don't remember this. So anyway.
Yeah.
I did want to say also, I liked the aliens and the way they looked in the movie because when they showed up, I was like, oh, tentacles, that's original. So then later when she's in there with them and you go, oh, okay, hold on, those were toes. I get it or whatever. That's fine. That was neat. But when I reread the story, I hadn't remembered that they were cylindrical with even spaced arms or legs or whatever all the way around.
Yeah.
I was like, they could have done that. That would have been super cool. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. They kind of did that, but you're right. It didn't, you know, they look kind of like hands upside down kind of.
Yeah. The choice was valid. That's fine. Yeah. I'm not going to complain. I'm just going to say, I did have one thing to mention that I listened to a podcast. It's called Real, R-E-E-L, Theology. I don't know if you've ever heard it.
I have not, no.
Okay. They have quite a few episodes, and I do enjoy them, and it's usually a panel group of mostly guys, occasionally a girl, and they're all sorts of Christians. But I think they're all Protestants, and they range in formality levels of their liturgy, you know, like maybe one's Anglican or close to it, and then the others are varying levels of formality. So anyway, they brought up a very interesting point that hadn't occurred to me. And they said, and this is from somebody who comes from a formal background, more like Catholicism. It says, does the liturgy, which is language for worship, change how we think or transform us?
Hmm.
Because in Catholicism, and we talked about this a lot in the Lord of the Rings podcasts, language does what it says. So when it's, you know, the wine becomes the blood, the bread becomes the, or the wafer becomes the Eucharist, becomes, you know, Jesus's body, it happens.
Yeah.
Because it's said. And it's a lot like Jesus's miracles where he's saying, go home, your child is healed. And it is, you know, or stand up, you're healed. And they are.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I would say that it definitely affects what we think about, right? No mm-hmm. question whatsoever about that. You know, what is said in liturgy matters because, you know, not only do you have that transformative stuff, you know, the creative words of Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever Jesus says something, you know, it becomes reality.
Right.
But in liturgy, I would say that, yeah, the language definitely does matter because, well, we want it to be accurate, right? But we also, it can affect what we think about. Does it affect how we think? I'm not sure, but does it affect what we think about what's happening? I think definitely. Just the same way, like a really great piece of poetry would make you feel transcendent about something, you know? A stream or whatever it might be.
Also, now that I'm thinking about it, I think the language also just kind of opens up and creates a space
mm-hmm.
where God can touch you.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with the less formal prayers and things, but the prayers we're coming up with on our own or the liturgical things that are a lot less formal just have a lot less space. They're more directed. They're more like light, trying to get to the point as fast as possible because that's just what it's aimed at, you know. Mm-hmm. Gee, I sure hope I pass that test today. Hope I don't get picked for jury duty. Whereas when you have a big liturgical tradition, we're kind of familiar with the language that's used. We understand the formality of it. But because it is more complex and layered, it can hit us in different ways if we're present and paying attention. And God can slide in that then and go, ha, been trying to get you.
Yeah.
Here's something you hadn't thought of. To me.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
I just kind of loved that little, I mean, a lot of what they talked about was, you know, some of the same stuff we did, but
right.
That was the thing that was really different.
But yeah. I mean, we go to mass, you know, once a week at least, right? And we hear that week after week after week after week. And one of the things that is really remarkable, you know, especially when we get to Holy Week, you notice this when they start to change things a little bit, or even, you know, during Lent, you know, something's missing, you know, like the Gloria or whatever. But when those things happen, once you're used to being in that space all the time, it's kind of profound. You know, it's like, whoa, there's no Gloria. That goes here. Mm-hmm. Why is that? You know,
or it's back.
Right. Yeah. Or it's back, you know, amazing, you know, on Easter morning, it's awesome.
Right.
And what the one on, isn't it on Holy Saturday? It's a service, right? It's not really a mass. And they kind of just walk out at the end. Good Friday. Okay. So they just walk out at the end.
Yeah.
And you're like, you're not finished. So it feels like a door that's open and then they close it, you know, when you come back together. So on Easter Vigil. But it's amazing what you can do in that space.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And that goes along with the symbolism because on Good Friday, after they clean everything off the altar and everything out of the space around the altar, it feels different.
Yeah.
It is empty. It to me anyway, it kind of like my heart echoes.
Mm.
Yep. And all Saturday feels that way to me because I know none of that stuff is there. There are no candles. There are no cloths. There's nothing. He's gone.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So that reflects too the symbolism there.
Amazing. Very cool. Very cool. Wow. Yeah. Profound stuff. love this movie.
So good. I'm so glad you picked it.
Is there anything else either of you would like to say about the movie?
Not me.
Are we good?
Oh.
Okay. Well, thank you both for being here. Rose, thank you for joining us.
Yes.
It was a pleasure.
Awesome. That's fantastic. So what is up next? Let's see.
Speaking of writing history.
Looking.
Isn't it The Daughter of Time?
That's it. Daughter of Time. Tay. By Josephine Tay. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I have it's it right
mystery.
Here.
Oh, do you?
Yep.
Okay.
Here it is.
Excellent.
And this is a mystery, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Inspector Alan Grant of Scotland Yard. Yep, that's what the back says.
That's
in a hospital. That's not all it says. It's just only part of it.
Okay, good.
Yeah. He is a man of the cloth problem. Without the cloth. No, that's not what it says.
No.
It says, beridden in a hospital while recuperating from a broken leg and exceedingly bored, becomes fascinated with contemporary portrait of Richard III that bears no resemblance to the wicked uncle of history. Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So instead of an armchair mystery, it's a
bedridden mystery.
Bedridden mystery, yes. So.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that.
Good.
That's great. And we read another one by her at some other point.
The Franchise Affair.
That's it. That's right. Cool.
Yeah.
And which one was that? That was good story number 5.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
That's right.
Oh, we are digging into the past here.
Number 5. All right.
I can't believe we did that early.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, it's time to do another one.
You bet.
Yep.
All right, well, great. So we got that. So thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yes, and we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
In a couple weeks, right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.